You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
So what I want to do this podcast about is, what are the real 10 major problems? We've interviewed 500 of the smartest people in the world. Many of them have told us big major problems in society. And I kind of want to identify what are the actual problems that we've seen. And I don't want to give an opinion on the things I don't know about. But what are the things that actually seem to be real problems that have been discussed on this podcast? That super smart people who are deeply invested in these situations have come to us with credible data and science and so on. And there are solutions, but I don't think anyone's going to do them. And by the way, when there's solutions, that also means there's opportunities for businesses. And, you know, people make a lot of money that way. It's possible to make a lot of money that way.
But I like that because that seems like off the beaten path. But, you know, Reid Hoffman recently wrote something. He wrote like an editorial a few weeks ago just saying like, crazy today, obvious tomorrow, you know?
Right. Are you rolling? So, Steve, this is like a podcast. So, I'm an optimist in general. Like, if since the beginning of history you bet against the ultimate rise in the economy, you would have lost because the economy is at the highest point ever. Yeah. Like at any point in the past 200 years, every time people said, "Oh, the American economy is going to fail, capitalism is failing," if you had shorted, you know, or sold against America for the long run, you would have been wrong because the stock market is at all-time highs, the economy is at all-time highs, unemployment is at, you know, near all-time lows, blah, blah, blah. I'm not saying anything political. I know I'm overly optimistic. I'm probably over-optimistic about many issues. Like, I see people on Twitter arguing about, you know, genetically modified foods. Of course, since 1960, there's been arguments about climate change and who knows,
you
know.
Sure.
Like in 1989, the scientists were saying Manhattan was going to be underwater by 2000. Okay, now it's 2019, New York's not underwater. But the pushback when I say that is that, well, technology has changed, the predictions now are more accurate, so 2040 maybe it's
But also, be what did you say the other day when you said something about like, oh, if I'm doing poorly, it's, I'm mangling it, of course.
Yeah, but, yeah. When your neighbor is out of a job, it's a recession. When you're out of a job, it's a depression.
Yes. So all politics are local, obviously. Like if you were a coal miner and you lost your job and
right.
you were pessimistic about that.
And this will occur. So what I want to do this podcast about is, what are the real 10 major problems? We've interviewed 500 of the smartest people in the world. They've told us many of them are focused on the personal, but some of them are focused on the macro. Many of them have told us big major problems in society. And I kind of want to identify what are the actual problems that we've seen. And I don't want to give an opinion on climate change because actually nobody has spoken to us about climate change. I don't want to give an opinion on the things I don't know about. But what are the things that actually seem to be real problems that have been discussed in this podcast that super smart people who are deeply invested in these situations have come to us with credible data and science and so on?
Well, I mean, we've had a few conversations, when I say we, I mean you, with Roger McNamee and about, you know, the perils of Facebook and Google and these huge companies with data.
Right, so let me summarize that one. So Roger McNamee, a billionaire. I didn't even know he was invested in as far back as Google. He's invested in Oracle, Cisco. Then he was an early investor in Facebook. He recently wrote a book, Zucked, about how kind of the tyranny of data, all this data that's being collected. And I gave him an example where I bought a Kurt Vonnegut book yesterday afternoon, yesterday evening, even though I have never once searched for Kurt Vonnegut, as far as I can remember, at least for years, on YouTube. I logged onto YouTube, all my usual videos that I like came up, and then dead center in the middle of that was a Kurt Vonnegut commencement speech video. So somehow in those few hours, my credit card data had been sold into Google's system. Somehow, this I can only guess this is true because I don't know how, you know, every other video was a comedian that I had watched recently, and then suddenly in the middle, Kurt Vonnegut commencement speech. Well, I had never seen a Kurt Vonnegut video before. I barely knew what he looked like. So
I of course know what he looks like from Back to School where
with Rodney Dangerfield.
Yeah.
But you know, the bigger issue, so Roger McNamee brought up in a recent podcast something I never thought of. If the way your mouse moves, Google can track that. And so his question was, who's gonna know first if you have Parkinson's? You or Google? And then Google is under no obligation to tell you. They can actually just sell that information that you have Parkinson's to the highest bidder, which would be an insurance company. And you might not even know you have Parkinson's. So, and he said there's hundreds, he said there's not thousands, there's hundreds of thousands of things like this that they know about you that you don't, that they could either sell to the highest bidder or use to manipulate you in some opinion or other. Like they make more money from Mercedes as an advertiser, so they can influence you to buy a Mercedes over a Prius and so on. And election,
certainly Amazon
and so on.
Does that, with the sponsored posts and stuff like that.
So data influencing us based on our cognitive biases, based on the fact that we give up data in so many different ways that are not even expected, like Google knows what temperature you keep your various rooms in. Alexa can hear you talk all the time.
And Nest and things like that, right.
You know, and he brought up something interesting. You know, Apple doesn't release data as much. And I remember one time I was doing some research for an app I was thinking of developing, and a critical question I had was, can Android see what other things are on your phone, and can the iPhone see what other things are on your phone? Can you write software to see what other apps are on your phone? And the iPhone can't. I can't write an app that can see what other apps you have, but on the Android, I can. So it's interesting. That's I only thought that was a symptom of the application programmer interface, but it's actually a symptom of their policies on data.
I was going to ask you a question because, you know, apropos of your feeling about stuff, and I think it's a little simplistic to say, you know, don't worry, be happy. You know, there are certain things that are concerning people, but you actually have a background on this. You have a graduate degree or tried to get a graduate degree in computer science and a computer programmer. How have things changed since then? You know, we always think about this apocalyptic future or, you know.
Two things have changed. One is, like, programming techniques have not changed. They're the same as they were 20, 30 years ago. And this is Peter Thiel's point, that there hasn't really been that many great steps in technological innovation since the 70s. But two things have changed. One is computers have gotten faster. So, you know, Moore's law is computers double in speed every 2 years. And it's been true. Computers are, a smartphone is faster than the most powerful supercomputer from like 15, 20 years ago. And so computers can crunch through data so much faster than ever before, trillions and trillions of pieces of data, whereas it would have taken them days 20 years ago. Now it takes seconds. So that's changed. The other thing that's changed is there is more data. When it never was the case that my credit card data would instantly go into the TV shows I would watch, and the ads I would see. And you know, whether you keep your living room at 68 and your bedroom at 73 degrees, that data was never available for by your insurance company. Your mouse movements, where your eyes are looking at the computer screen, where you click, what you know, your likes, your preferences are all available to every major company in the world that's willing, that has the money to pay for it. So why is this a problem? Is maybe because, and this is came up in our podcast with Sam Harris, maybe we don't have as much free will as we think. We all think we're rational beings, but the reality is, as Daniel Kahneman has shown with cognitive biases, we are influenced by so many factors in our environment, and even knowing that, there's no way to really correct for that, or it's very hard to correct for that. So the idea is, the problem is that given all of your data and given a bad actor that wants to manipulate your behavior, that can be done without your knowledge. And even with your knowledge, there's nothing you can really do about it.
Well, what if you go off the grid? Like, a lot of people have felt, you know, Wall Street Journal had an article about how people were even simplifying to like a flip phone to like get rid of the constant whizzing and whirring of that. And
Sure. But realistically, like, so you and I know all this.
Yeah.
And we've talked to all the, you know, not only have we talked to Roger McNamee, but in preparation for Roger McNamee, I talked to everybody ranging from CIA to advertisers who use all the data, to Democrats, to Republicans, to, you know, very influential people in various aspects of this space. So given everything that I know, I have a smartphone, I use Uber, I use Google, I use Facebook, I use Twitter, I use Instagram, I like things, I watch YouTube videos.
Sure.
I have Alexa, I have smart home.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't Apple change Pay, my behavior probably, because I like the benefits right now, but at some point the point is that it'll tilt so that the negatives far outweigh the positives of these products that I'm using.
And I mean, I feel like, how did 9/11 affect this, right? It gave people more permission to be invasive, right? They a lot of what these companies did were under the guise of like, hey, we need to figure out what people are doing so that we're proactive.
Right. So the CIA started InQtel, which is their VC fund, which funded a lot of companies that use artificial intelligence to analyze data. And, you know, you just look at the list of InQtel companies and you can see the kind of data they're analyzing, and you can start guessing what they're planning on using it. So this is problem number one. Again, it hasn't been a problem. It maybe has been a problem that's affected our lives. We don't really know. Like Roger McNamee's point is, it affected the 2016 election. It definitely affects our buying behavior. Whether that's a positive or negative, it's hard to know.
It could affect you getting a job.
It could affect your career decisions. Yeah. It could affect...
Well, like if somebody knew you had Parkinson's or knew you kept searching for stuff and, you know, not even just stuff you post online, but stuff that's unbeknownst to other people that they could find out, you know, and that's been happening before too. People might check your credit history before hiring you to have a sense of how reliable you are. So
right. Also, like, let's say Facebook knows your age and they know your likes, and let's say you like a certain type of music, and then let's say now they know you just liked a certain kind of baby stroller, or you posted a picture of baby stroller. They know you have a baby. They know all your family history. Maybe people with your exact profile do X.
Yeah.
And now they see me. I'm beginning to look like your profile. Let's say I have a similar background and maybe I just had a baby. So they know, based on thousands of people like you, they know a month from now what kind of things I'm going to be buying. They can say to the advertisers who pay the most, hey, James is, people like James are starting a month from now, they're going to be looking at this, so you should pay us now so we start influencing James and putting these ads in front of James, or these articles in front of James. Yeah. And it'll drive up the conversion rates for Mercedes versus Kia.
Yeah.
And Mercedes pays more than Kia. So, you know, maybe I would have bought a Kia, but instead I buy a Mercedes because Facebook benefits. And I don't really benefit because it's the same car. So again, it's hard. It feels like there's a gray area where something's wrong versus who knows. But in general, all these things together could be extremely bad.
I would say two things. I always liked where Maya Angelou said, if you don't like something, change it. And if you can't change it, change your attitude. And
I don't know how to do either here, though.
Well, but essentially, Roger and you know, we're talking about that. Like, what can we do about this? You know, how do we, you know, like, most people feel helpless, and that this behemoth companies and the inevitability of them doing it. So he's saying we have choices.
You know, talking to, you know, Robert Cialdini's been on our podcast with Influence. He talks a lot about cognitive biases that influence our decisions. Sam Harris came on to talk about, you know, our loss of free will. We've talked to Eddie Ibanez about data and how the government's getting more aggressive, how they're using it, the government, not just advertisers. So we're being attacked from all angles. I don't know what the solution is. So I'm kind of posing, What are the problems we've heard where the solutions to me are unknown? So Roger McNamee's point is become an activist, start the conversation. I think that's the best we can do.
Yes.
And then we see, you know, if there's smarter people than us who could come up with solutions. So next problem, I would say, we've talked about it a lot. I feel I helped start the conversation as early as 2005, but now we just see the news breaking, you know, about this college admission yes. scandal, people paying millions to get their, you know, shitty little kids into, you know, top tier schools. And we've talked before on podcasts how, you know, colleges, the fact that tuitions are rising faster than inflation, the fact that the government has unfairly backed student loans, you know, saddling an entire generation of kids with $1.6 trillion in debt, how this could lead to greater income inequality in society, which has been historically, you know, the historical outcomes of that have never been positive. They've always been negative. And I hate using the word income inequality because it's almost like a socialist catchphrase, which I don't think is a solution either. Stalinism didn't work, obviously. Maoism didn't work. You know, any large society that's a diverse population, socialism does not seem to work at all. And even in smaller countries with a more homogenous society like Cuba, it doesn't seem to work either, or North Korea. So I'm not talking about that, but it does seem with rising income inequality, there are huge societal problems. There's a book, The Great Leveler by Walter Scheidel. We should maybe have him on the podcast.
Okay.
He's looked for the past 3,000 years at every society with large income inequality. My point is a big source of the income inequality is student loan debt and the way the educational system is set up. And why do I pick out that versus medical costs or other problems? Well, tuitions have risen faster than inflation every single year by a fact 10x faster than inflation, whereas medical costs have gone up only 3x faster than inflation. 20 million Americans are saddled with student loan debt, most of them young Americans who would have ideally started companies or create innovations. Now they have to do other jobs to pay back their debt. And I see this as a big societal problem. I can offer solutions, which is stop backing student loans, but most people won't agree with me.
I feel like that's a more soluble problem than what we were just talking about. I think like...
Yes.
I do think so. I think that there's...
There is a solution, actually. I mean, I know what the solution is, which is don't back student loans. You want to increase the supply of accredited schools while keeping the demand the same. So make all online universities accredited so that you're not hampered in getting a job if you go to Code Academy versus Harvard. You know, maybe give financial incentives for colleges, I mean, for corporations to look at skill acquisition versus... degrees. So there's a variety of solutions, but I don't see society taking
those
solutions.
But last week, I visited this company, Pursuit, in Queens, you know, and they have 140 students who are learning to program, and the tuition might be $45,000, but they don't pay it. They'll pay back once they get a job.
Yeah, stuff like that's good. Or here's one that I like that no one's done. It is a business idea. Let's make an exchange where... And I hate to put it so bluntly, but human beings are what's on the exchange. Yeah. I don't mean like, it almost sounds like slavery, but I'm saying like, take 10% of your income and put it in a black box and your 10% of future income for the next 10 years and have people bid that they want that. So if I can buy Steve Cohen's future income for the next 10 years for, let's say, $10,000, 10% of your income.
That's about right.
No, but that's a bargain because I think you'll make much more than that.
Let's hope so.
And so I'm giving an extreme example. You'll make, you know, 20 times that, 10% more than that.
Yeah, let's sky's the limit, James.
So I can take a student, and a high school student, and using data about that student, I can say, okay, this is the type of person where I can... invest a little bit in only 10%. You don't want to give all their future income because then they don't have incentive. But I want to buy 10% of their future income for their next 20 years, and they can use this to pay for skill acquisition, not necessarily college, but skill acquisition. Doesn't have to worry about things. because I'm already giving him some money.
Yeah.
And that might be another way to create a $1 billion business and solve the problem.
Well, I was going to say a couple of things. One, so instead of pork bellies, you have like people. But I believe there was something similar on a show you were a technical advisor on in Billions, where they had took stock, like these wealthy people were taking stock in like baseball players, and they were essentially buying an interest in them. Like,
right. Yeah. And what's very common is in poker, people that's an industry. You diversify and you buy lots of positions. Like I can buy 10% in like 20 different poker players, and you know, people make a lot of money that way. It's possible to make a lot of money that way. And so this type of discussion can happen, and that's interesting.
But I like that because I do think a lot of people talk about like entrepreneurship and seem like that seems like off the beaten path. But you know, Reid Hoffman recently wrote something. He wrote like an editorial a few weeks ago just saying like crazy today, obvious tomorrow, you know?
Right.
And the folks at Republic and other people who are doing things like that.
Oh, and I've talked to Kendrick, the CEO of Republic, about this idea.
Oh, wow.
And he does think it's possible. So look, it might be in my future, but I'm happy if anyone else says this. This is a viable idea that I personally would invest in. I don't like to just put all my eggs in one investment. I would never invest always just in the stock market. If I could invest in long-term investments in smart people that I believe in, I would be happy to do that. It helps their lives. It helps their careers. It solves the student debt issue. It helps create another generation of entrepreneurs and innovators. And you diversify. You don't put all your eggs in one basket there either. And look, peer-to-peer lending is a form of that. This is just a little bit more aggressive than peer-to-peer lending.
Or microloans, you know.
Yeah, microloans and peer-to-peer lending. And look, Muhammad Yunus, is that his name? He won a Nobel Prize for coming up with that idea.
Sure.
I'm
nominating you. I want to go to...
I think this is a little more aggressive than that.
Stockholm, is it?
Yes.
Book our tickets for 2020.
Private plane to Stockholm. That's problem number two. This rising income inequality caused by a broken education system, and there are solutions, but I don't think anyone's going to do them. The first and by the way, when there's solutions, that also means there's opportunities for businesses. I think with the data one, I don't know what the solution is, but whatever the solution is, there's probably an opportunity for business. So we've had on Gabriel Weinberg, the DuckDuckGo search engine, that's the one search engine that holds onto your privacy. He's based in Philadelphia. We should have him on again, particularly given this Roger McNamee stuff.
No problem.
So there are some economic opportunities. I don't have my, and maybe there's you can put your data in a crypto format, like to keep track of where your data is going. That might be a business opportunity. Yeah. So I don't know. I haven't put my head around it much. Okay, problem number three. What is problem number three that we've heard from guests? Let's talk about Floyd Landis and steroids in the business in athletics. His point is that there is no solution because let's say your entire life you dream of being a baseball player. You played in little league, you played in high school, you played in college, now you're in the minor leagues, and now someone tells you, hey, if you really want to be a top professional baseball player, I've known you devoted the past 20 years of your life to this, and you never heard this before, but guess what? You're going to have to start taking some serious drugs. And Floyd Landis' point is that, and he won the Tour de France in 2006, Floyd's point was, is that they're trapped. This is all they've done is baseball. And now they're told to really hit the income levels they want and reach the level they want. They have to take these illegal drugs. And so that's what perpetuates the system. And it's insidious. And we're not having the conversation with our kids about it. So once again, the first solution is having the conversation. The second solution, I think, is...
But if you remember, like, I remember Alex Rodriguez, a noted steroid user. And he was involved with a guy named Houdin whose son died of steroids. You know, he was like, don't do drugs. And eventually it was disclosed that he himself...
How did he die of it?
How the kid... I think he was in high school and I know that... I believe he's in Michigan somewhere, but I want to say Taylor Houdin or we'll put that in the notes. But like essentially he... I think he was abusing steroids at a young age. I don't know if he had a heart attack or something, but
So abusing these drugs is two problems, right? Yeah. One is that sports becomes unfair. So it's the players that are breaking the law have advantage over the players and teams that are not. The other thing is that there's side effects that are dangerous and that we don't fully understand them. And this isn't just athletics. This is also every area, because look at like kids now, every kid's addicted to Adderall, and that's a form of doping. The kids on Adderall literally makes you smarter. So the kids on Adderall are scoring better on their tests than the kids not on Adderall. And not in every case. If you actually have ADD, Adderall doesn't make you smarter. It just makes you more, you know, like every other kid. But
well, I think it comes down to, and it's ironic, you know, we're talking about that college scandal, and one of the women there, Jane Buckingham, who was a college advisor, and you know, she had on Twitter, "Don't cheat," you know, and you see that, and it's there's been a lot written about like honesty and integrity. University of Virginia has an honor system, or other places like that, and you know, I'm sure most people are like, why should I be honest? Like, okay, I'm a Tour de France, and I sit there and do it honestly, and I'm not doping my blood. I'm not taking HGH, and I'm finishing 100th out of, you know, where the guy to the left and the right of me are cheating.
Right. So honesty is going to be another problem, actually. But I think the solution here is get rid of the FDA and make all these drugs legal. Because here's and that sounds horrible. But here's what will happen is then the conversation will happen with young kids because it's no longer considered abhorrent to do these steroids because it'll become common knowledge that everyone is using them. So the kids will have be able to make a decision at a younger age. Do I really want to pursue this as a career? But the other positive outcome is that doctors will then be allowed to research these drugs, you know, maybe make drugs that don't have the side effects or less harmful side effects. Kids can make better, more informed decisions. And then look, then we really see, you know, again, doping in non-illegal drugs, we don't call it doping, but it happens. Like people change their diet to have better performance or people, you know, and they use genetically modified foods to change their performance. Or they take drugs that their doctor, illegal drugs that are prescribed.
In the 50s and 60s, and they called them greenies, and baseball players would be like, that's a performance enhancer.
Yeah, and again, Adderall is a prescribed drug. There's other prescribed drugs that are performance enhancers, not as strong as some of these extreme steroids that athletes use. But just make all these things legal, and you could have then a more efficient conversation for kids when they're younger. B, you can eliminate many of the side effects. C, companies will benefit because companies will start selling more drugs that will be helping people. Maybe, like with many drugs, maybe there'll be orphan uses that will cure diseases or help people deal with things like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. You know, I'm sure many of these, you know, performance enhancing drugs would be performance enhancing for elderly people who have weaknesses. Just like I'll take an extreme example. What was originally used for Viagra? It was a blood thinner.
Oh, interesting. Well, I was going to say Propecia was, you know, like, was really for about your like blood, and then it promoted hair growth. You know?
So
not that I've been taking. James is taking for people, you know.
Too much. I take the chewables.
Yeah, exactly.
But the whole point about Viagra is that maybe it shouldn't be used as an ED drug. I'm not saying yes or no, but maybe it should be used as a blood thinner. But there's all these orphan uses of these drugs once you study them further, and. I don't know. I think it could general help the health
There's
of society,
unintended
health
consequences
of the economy.
From that. Yeah.
And why not we see the limits of human performance by using every means at our disposal and seeing how fast a human can run, seeing how fast a human could bicycle or hit a ball or whatever. I don't think it's a horrible thing if these drugs are made legal, particularly if that leads to better understanding of the side effects and maybe curing them and so on. So that's another problem.
The light, you know, if you shed light on it, then it will be an infectant, disinfectant. Yeah.
But here's the problem with all these things. Anytime we come up with a solution, it's not going to happen. No government is going to say, oh sure, you know, except Russia.
Yeah, exactly.
No government is going to say, let little kids start doping so they're better in Little League. Like, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And you could say, okay, make it for 18 and up. Okay, still, the U.S. is not going to get rid of the FDA. There's so much money that the government makes on that. It costs $1 billion or maybe $2 billion now for a legitimate cancer drug to get approved by the FDA. Not that the government makes all that money, but for a company that thinks they've cured cancer, if they don't have $2 billion in the bank, they're not going to get their, no one is going to benefit from the cancer curing drug. Which is partly
why they justify the high cost, because all that research and...
Right. Yeah. Like Soliris, I don't know what disease it cures, costs $84,000 a month or something like that.
Wow.
I'm just guessing. I think it's about
that. Sure.
But I don't know of any other...
But I feel... But getting back to like original premise about optimism, you saw two people were cured of AIDS recently, and people are optimistic about Alzheimer cures or a lot of other stuff. Yeah.
But AIDS has been always a fast-track disease that gets through the FDA very quickly, much more cheaply. And yes, thank God now through the studies of genes, those AIDS cures are related to the... You know... Earlier we mentioned Moore's law, which is that computers double in speed every 2 years. There's an equivalent law in biotech, like the sequencing of the genome and so on, where biotech, I think it goes up 4x in speed every 2 years.
Oh, wow.
So that compound, so it used to cost $10 million to sequence the genome. Now it costs $100 to sequence the genome. And it's going to even get, and now we have CRISPR to modify genes. And that's how AIDS is being cured, is by modifying the genes that fight AIDS. And still, it's not understood enough. Only two people have been cured. You have to have a special set of genes and so on. But again, I don't see the world suddenly saying, look, let's just let research run rampant on drugs. We don't need billions of dollars to get through the FDA. I don't see steroids being approved because we've been so trained to thinking it's bad behavior. Little kids die.
Sure.
My argument is less kids will die if they start taking them legally or if they have the conversation. But I say this is a solution, but I don't think it's a solution that'll ever be enacted. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. So what's another problem?
Well, there's 99 problems. In the words of Jay-Z. No, but I'm trying to think of what are some other problems out there? Overcrowding.
But that's been discussed on the podcast.
Oh, that we've discussed. Okay.
You bring up honesty, and we've talked a lot about free speech with people like Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris.
That's a great one. Yeah.
And what we're seeing now is that, of course, everybody says, of course, you are allowed to have free speech, and yet you can't. If you say a political opinion, you can say whatever you want, but you're not free of consequences. So if you say a political opinion that everyone around you disagrees with, they will punish you for it.
Well, you've talked about, I believe you talked about Jamie Kilstein. I mean, I think what you're talking about also is the culture of canceling culture. You wrote about Louis C.K. and trying out jokes. I mean, as a comedian.
Trying out jokes in private.
Right. So I think that's probably a problem. You know, just this culture of, you know, you saw, we talked about like at Evergreen University with.
Brett Weinstein.
Idea of conformity of public opinion. And I believe you touched on it with Sam Harris about espousing opinions that aren't great or that aren't perceived that well. And how do you deal with it? And we saw it with the Oscars. With Kevin Hart, you saw it with Louis C.K.
So Kevin Hart, what was the exact issue? Because I don't read the news.
10 years ago, he had said he had made jokes about if his son were gay, he wouldn't want to, you know, and he made homophobic remarks.
So clearly that's a joke, right? Like,
yeah.
Nobody would say, oh, if my kid.
But he put it on Twitter. It wasn't just up on stage, but yes, I believe he was.
Right, so, okay, let's even say he was wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's say he was ethically. Wrong, and it was hateful. His speech was almost the equivalent of a hate crime, whatever. Let's say it incited people because he's such an inspiration to many people. Let's just say it's just dark and evil. It was, and it's 10 years ago. The Oscars said, we don't want you, or no, the Oscars, because of the heat, the Oscars was criticizing him, and then he dropped out, right? Is that what happened?
He dropped out, and he clumsily handled it. You know, he was defiant, and later on, like, Ellen DeGeneres tried to get him to reconcile, and I don't think he handled it adroitly. He probably would admit as much.
And then I think the Oscars wanted him back, right?
They did want him back, and I just think he was sort of like, you know what, I've moved on. I'm sorry. You know, he did an interview with Mike Pastrana. He's like, I'm not apologizing. I'm done already.
I don't want to say it was disingenuous because it was not. He was done. But what giving him the benefit of the doubt, what I learned afterwards was that the Oscars doesn't pay these guys and it takes 6 weeks of work and that guy can make tens of millions of dollars in 6 weeks. So,
They might pay like $15,000 for 6 weeks of work. And that's essentially what Jimmy Kimmel said. Like, it's sort of a thankless task. You're going to divide all these people. It's a lot of work. And it's really a hard situation to win because if you have a very anesthetized kind of performance and everybody's like, you have no bite. If you say some things that are risque, Seth MacFarlane did it years ago when he made his kind of jokes.
David Letterman.
People. Yeah. James Franco didn't like the World on Fire.
The only Oscar guy they ever liked is Billy Crystal.
Yeah, for sure.
But I just by coincidence, and it has nothing to do with any of my other activities, I met with the guy who produced the Oscars the day after the Oscars.
Oh, wow.
And he said it was just great just having everybody hand off the mic to the next person.
Oh, wow.
Like, so they might start doing
it. And the ratings were kind of up for it, yeah.
But here's the real problem I see is not so much the free speech, is that people label themselves in a group, and then it becomes
identity
this group
politics.
Thing.
Yeah.
So let's say you say you're a conservative, or let's say you say you're a feminist, or let's say you say you're pro-choice or pro-life. Now, I find two things. One is you hate everybody who disagrees with you, but you're not always honest about your own actions. Like, oh, I need to make an exception here about my beliefs.
Sure.
So I'll hate you for all of your beliefs against mine. But when I have to switch my beliefs, it's just a special situation. And I have this one story, which I've never spoken about on the podcast, but a friend of mine labels herself a feminist and heard of a story where a friend of hers and a former boss of hers basically, and I don't know who this was. Otherwise, I'd be more frank with the names. But basically, this person beat the hell out of his wife, hired a doctor to sew the wife up privately because it was a well-known person, apparently. And then the doctor said to the wife, you need to divorce him or I'm going public with this. And then the guy threatened the doctor, called her husband and said, oh, wow, the doctor's cheating, yeah, on him, left bad Yelp reviews anonymously for the doctor. And then I said to my friend, the feminist, so are you going to still go to his party? And she was like, yeah, he gave me my first job. You know, I kind of have to go. Right. And I'm like, you know, you can't call yourself a feminist and go to the party, sure, of the guy, the 40th year birthday party of the guy who beat the shit out of his wife. Like, that's not feminist behavior. It's really, sure, opposite of feminist behavior. And she literally thought I was mentally ill for not calling her a feminist. Like, she, because there's, yeah, some kind of bias when you groupthink is a cognitive bias, and it so strongly confirms your identity that you can't handle when somebody says, no, you're not behaving in that way.
Well, it's more about belonging to that group and feeling like you're part of that affiliation rather than holding up those ideals. You know, and that happens with a lot of people. Like, you know, you've seen it over years. Like, you call yourselves Christians. Shouldn't Jesus say, turn the other cheek or be charitable? And so I do think that happens a lot where, yeah, there's a dissonance there because people never feel like, well, that's not me. And yeah, I think we have to be more mindful. We just talked about it with people who are like, no, let's be fair. Don't cheat. And then privately they do that. And we see that in all areas. You know, so there's a, yeah, mild degree of hypocrisy. I mean, what you're speaking of is hypocrisy, lack of self-awareness, the old, how come everybody drives faster than me is a lunatic and everybody drives slower than me is a cripple, you know?
And like, politics is kind of an interesting social experiment. I mean, we've seen so many cases where, yeah, a senator will say, there should be no gay marriage.
Yes.
Get gay this, gay that. And then it turns out they're arrested for kind of, you know, having sex with guys in public or whatever.
Yes.
Like, so, and people thought, oh, this is isolated. This high end of hypocrisy is isolated to politics. So for instance, I just read a study where the theory was politicians cheat on their spouses more than in other professions, like more than lawyers or doctors. And so they did the study on politicians, lawyers, and doctors. And it turns out it's exactly similar.
Oh, wow.
So because the theory was if you're in a position of power and you have more opportunity, potentially you're going to cheat more. But it turns out it's across the board. People are dishonest, even though, sure, even if they say it's your face, they're honest.
But I found your example of that person who was that vicious and a horrible human being. You know, look, a lot of people will talk about that, right? Like just what you said in politics, where it could be presidential people from a certain party. And if your person does it and there's, you know, we see that now in a divided country, you know? So you're right. I mean, what you're speaking about is the problem of identity politics and this person's on our team, so that's okay, you know?
Right. And there's a passage in the Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. So he was a prominent writer and he got sentenced to Siberia and then he wrote about it in the Gulag Archipelago. He quotes a newspaper from 1920s Russia, which basically says, it doesn't matter if you're guilty or innocent of the crime, if you belong to the, yeah, bourgeois class. So, and that's identity politics in early communism, and now we're seeing it here.
Well, yes. And George Bernard Shaw said, you know, patriotism is believing your country is the best just because you happen to have been born there, you know? And I think that, you know,
Which is a cognitive bias, availability,
yes,
bias.
But I also think, like, in which we all have to train ourselves to some degree to call balls and strikes and to say, okay, we might not like President Trump or, you know, Hillary Clinton, but you have to admit this thing is pretty good that they're doing, or, you know, and I think, you know, I might support Jesse Smollett, but what he did was pretty freaking horrible to make up a crime, to make himself the victim. So you have to, and I think if certain stations on that side. If you're MSNBC and you didn't cover it that much, I think shame on them. You know,
And it's funny.
Or Fox or the other things for not covering things that might be detrimental to their cause. And again, that brings up the problem of it's a divided country and people are not looking for information, looking for affirmation. You're watching it to get the dopamine hit of saying, yes, they're right, let's get them. And, you know, so it's different. You're not really objectively looking for truth.
Yeah. So,
uncomfortable truths.
I think this is such a huge problem. You could do 10 podcasts in a row about it and still not come up with a solution. I think the solution is, like you say, kind of being aware that you might be wrong, but people just have a hard time with it. I don't totally agree with Daniel Kahneman, as much as I hate to disagree with a Nobel Prize winner and a guy who's done 50 years of research on this. Maybe there's a 5% chance we can sometimes get over these cognitive biases. I think Sam Harris
the listener, what does Daniel Kahneman say about cognitive bias? I mean, he feels like it's inevitable that we're kind of helpless.
Yeah, it's like George Bernard Shaw. Yeah. You think your country's the best because you're born in it, because you have patriotism. That's just luck of the universe that you were born in the U.S. versus the Germany. And but no matter where you're born, people seem to like their country the best or think their country is the best. And so that's a cognitive bias.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know, or what my friend was experiencing with me suggesting she might not be a feminist. That was her groupthink. It's inconceivable. Or if you believe so strongly that, you know, an education is important for kids, if you suggest there might be nuances to this, like about the rise in student loan debt, that maybe it doesn't take 4 years to acquire skills to succeed, that maybe accredited degrees is a scam, and now we see, you know, these admission scandals, you'll have a cognitive bias saying, no, education, you'll just say education is good. You won't even listen to the data. So, but I think there, or, you know, here's another cognitive bias. If all of my friends say a political candidate's good, I'm more likely to listen to my friends than to listen to strangers. I'll probably think that candidate's good without knowing anything about the candidate.
And bringing back it to Roger McNamee, he was talking about the filter bubble that exists on Facebook. So that, let's say you were already preconditioned to these groups, then they'll just keep ratcheting it up. So you stay on longer and that you feel validated and you feel incentivized to keep on there because they're telling you how correct, you're on the right path, and there are more people like you. So it only intensifies that kind of groupthink.
Those filter bubbles lead to a kind of weird what's called in-group, out-group bias. So a great example, I always think, if you've seen the movie 8 Mile with Eminem, he's in the final battle. He's battling, you know, he's the only white guy, and there's all these, you know, black people, African Americans. Yeah. Who have to kind of decide who's going to win the rap battle. And he's battling someone who seems like he belongs to the group of the audience.
Yes.
You know, they're all African American. And so he has to figure out how to make the audience in his group and his opponent in the out group, because people want to vote in group and they want to reject out group.
Right.
So what he does is very smart. He does his research. He realizes his opponent is middle class instead of lower class. So he changes the groups. He says, you know, one of the lines is, everybody in the 313, put your motherfucking hands up and follow me. And everybody there lived in the 313 area code, which is, you know, lower class Detroit. The other guy was not in the 313 area code.
The kid was in 248.
248. That's right. That's
Detroit.
No wonder. Whenever I get numbers from 248, it's usually from my friend, my white upper middle class friend.
On the other side of 8 Mile.
So that's the thing with cognitive biases, is that even when you're aware, if you're not aware of them, you're totally going to be dominated by them. But even if you're aware of them, I only give it like a 5%. You can move the needle a little bit, I think.
But the rapper Brand Nubian said, sometimes a brother's not a brother.
There you go. But you have to be aware of that.
Yeah.
You have to be aware of that line in order to be suspect.
Sure.
I think you have to, skepticism has to be learned.
Yeah.
And I've had some good mentors in this, because by studying the financial markets, knowing when to go against the crowd makes you the most money. So it took a long time of studying how to go against the crowd. And a lot of it I had to do through computer software. So like, I remember when I was first doing this, it was almost a common joke. If a company had a drug which it just they just found out caused brain aneurysms.
Yeah.
Those were usually the best investments because the stock would go down 40% in a day.
Wow.
And I would buy it and they would bounce. Just the data would show. So I had to go over, I couldn't say, forget it, I'm not investing in this company. It's going to zero. The data suggested, oh no, they're going to have a 10% bounce within the next 4 days, almost every time. And so I would invest. And, you know, I had to use data and software to overcome my biases.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, no, for sure. And I also, look, obviously people go on a limb. That's where the fruit is. You have to, you know, do things that other people don't do. Otherwise, you know, Seth Godin, the guest of the podcast, talks about that a lot, about just being safe and by the shore isn't really going to get you.
No. Like I always say to people, if you're not, like somebody sent me some writing and said, hey, can you please look at my article that I wrote on LinkedIn? And I did. And he said, send me any comments. And I don't think I was rude. But I was honest with him. I said, his article was something like 10 lessons every leader needs to know. And there was no story. There was just the lessons.
Yeah.
And I said, look, this is no good. Cause I need to know what you did wrong that you weren't born knowing these lessons.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
And you didn't start off being a leader and you were amazing. You were the one in a billion that was the best leader in the world. You had to learn these through failing and correcting yourself and failing and correcting yourself. What Anders Ericsson, who has been on our podcast, calls deliberate practice. Tell us the stories. And that's how we're going to learn now. Because right now I can't remember any of his lessons, but if he had told me some stories, maybe I would have. To his credit, he thanked me. I don't know if he ever rewrote anything or anything, but I hope he didn't take it personally. I had another example.
But you have to show him how you got to the top of the mountain, not just, hey.
Well, and a lot of it too is like, you know, we had Roy Niederhofer, a hedge fund manager on the podcast, super smart guy. He and I both worked for a hedge fund manager that really encouraged us to test. Do not make an investment unless you're testing all of your premises underneath it. And that was drilled into me. And that's how you test. That's how you get rid of biases by testing.
Ray Dalio talks about that we've had on the podcast about radical honesty and stress testing all your ideas, and not being afraid to be wrong, which brings us back to your point about self-identified feminist. Like, don't be afraid to say, oh, you know, maybe I'm not as much of, you know, kind of like that woman who had a vegetarian restaurant and then you saw the like food she was eating that was clearly not vegetarian.
Right. You know? And all right, so what's another problem in society that we've may or may not have solutions, or if they do have solutions, probably won't be listened to, but we've sort of seen on this podcast?
We haven't talked to anybody. I mean, we're all fearful. Like, think about our fears, right? Fearful of nuclear war, you know, and that ratcheting up, less so than, I mean, we weren't around during the Bay of Pigs and all that, where people were going under desks. But I think war is a concern, or being drafted if you have kids of draft age, and just escalating tensions, whether it's...
Yeah, so think about this.
Yeah.
There's probably more wars in the world now being fought than ever, but like, you know, and in different ways. And nuclear weapons are so much more powerful than in 1965 when we were ducking under desks, or you are, not me. No, I'm just kidding. You're younger than me. And that's called availability bias, which is what you see in the news is what you're going to be concerned about. It's why if we see, oh, another girl, her leg was bitten off by a shark, we suddenly think there's this huge shark problem all of a sudden on the coast of Florida. Oh, global warming's bringing all the sharks closer and they're hungrier and they're going to eat humans. But actually, there's less shark attacks than ever.
Yeah.
It's just, it's in the news, so we think it's a big concern. Nuclear war is a far greater concern. There's so many rogue nations now with potential nuclear weapons and nuclear science and capabilities. There's almost no way to avoid the problem, and yet we don't think about it. We think about climate change instead, which, again, I have no idea about the science or whatever, but it seems to me I'm much more fearful of a nuke going off somewhere than I am that Manhattan next year is going to be underwater.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure.
But again, that's an availability bias thing.
Out of sight, out of mind. I mean, it's kind of like the whole idea of Schrodinger's cat, where once you knew that it was dead, it became dead to you. Like, what you didn't know doesn't really I guess in some cases, like what you don't know doesn't hurt you is what essentially there.
But it does suggest though that the media can influence. But it's a two-edged sword, I guess, because we're telling the media what we like to read, and the media is telling us what we should be concerned about. But what's a problem that's come up on the podcast? Yet another one that's come up on the podcast that you know, because everybody has issues.
Sure.
The reason I brought up the guy's writing sample is that you have to say something outside of the common conversation, or else you're not saying something new. And then there's no point in writing. You have to be afraid before you hit publish, or else you're not, or else you're simply saying something that someone has said before. And so we know we've had a lot of people on the podcast that have addressed issues that have not been said before. What are some interesting ones? We've talked about a couple here. I'm just trying to think of I don't know what you're looking at any random guest. They probably brought up some issue.
About
Jay, what do you think? Any guests that have brought up or Robin? Any guests that have brought up any random issue that made us worried or afraid or there wasn't a solution?
Roger McNamee.
Right, so we're getting availability bias because Roger McNamee and Sam Harris were our last two podcasts.
What kind of stuff were you thinking? I mean, we talked about Floyd Landis and athletics.
We talked about steroids, college data, cognitive biases, groupthink.
You talked about the finances. I mean, the difference between the haves and the have-nots, and that.
Yeah, we talked about income inequality.
I'm just trying to think of
privacy, which is related to data.
We talked about Eddie Ibanez, who's been on anything that he's told you alarm you.
Yeah, yeah. So the idea that, when I say there's more wars that are being fought than ever, it's true. Particularly if you don't look at guns and bullets. If you look at like cyber warfare, basically every country is fighting every other country right now. Like everybody's trying to bring down everybody's electric grid.
Yeah.
So as an example, Eastern Europe, they have very sophisticated electric grids powering their countries. But what's not sophisticated is the routers connecting the smart grids are still, they might be routers from the 90s, which have known security flaws, and so other countries are hacking those routers, and battles like that are happening every single day. You know, that those types of battles, not just hitting routers, but all sorts of, you know, security flaws are being and cognitive flaws within computers are being and computer networks are being hacked, and so cyber warfare is this huge issue where there is no. There also is no solution.
And, you know, I'm not sure if we talked about it with Garry Kasparov, who, friend of the program.
Yes.
Fellow chess prodigy.
So on the podcast twice.
To a lot of people, when the names Kasparov and Altucher used about chess in the same breath, it's usually that Altucher, he's no Kasparov, you know, but...
it's true. But on the first one,
you're still pretty amazing at chess.
No, I'm
pretty Kasparov. Amazing, and it's been great getting to know him. But he's made that a mission of his, correct? Like, you know, just like cybersecurity and just trying to deal with the perils of it.
Yeah, and I think at a very easy way, it's being solved at the corporate level. So right now, here's what's happened to every Fortune 500 company: is that pretty much almost all of them have been invaded by what's called bot armies, meaning a virus gets into your email, you open it. The virus spreads to everybody else in the company you send emails to. And what a bot army is these tiny pieces of software. I'm calling them tiny. It's not really, but you can think of it this way. It's tiny pieces of software sitting on your computer. The computer, there's no way to get rid of them. The only way to get rid of them is to throw out your computer. And everybody wonders, well, how could this Facebook post or this Twitter post get thousands of likes from all over the world? How could it be so these hacks be, or how could these companies get these denial of service attacks from all over the world? It's because these bot armies are coming from all over the world. And so you can't block any one computer. You have to block billions of computers, and then new computers will start up. And so that's the role of these bot armies, is to kind of wage these wars and attacks on big websites or Facebook, Twitter, whatever. And so cyber warfare, and that was just one example of it, or I gave two examples of it, cyber warfare can't be stopped. There's no way. And then companies like VMware, or there's companies like Checkpoint, big security companies, big storage companies, Dell, EMC.
Kaspersky or whatever. Yeah.
No, Kaspersky, you can't trust, this is a Russian-made company. But so government employees are not allowed to use Kaspersky software. These battles, the bad guys are always smarter. I once asked a company, and I think I've talked about this on the podcast, I once asked a company whose job was to fight these bot armies, I said, how come you can't solve the problem? And it was all PhDs in this company. This guy said, no matter how smart we are, they're always smarter.
Wow. And that, bringing it full circle, like that's what happens with the abusers on the Olympics and all that. The cheaters are usually smarter, you know, they're
like that Russian guy, the doctor who kind of revealed what he does.
And that movie Icarus, you know, Brian Fogel, like,
It was the same thing. And then Floyd Landis talks about how they'll find a part of the path on the Tour de France where there's no media. Wow. And Lance Armstrong, or he didn't, I don't know if he said Lance Armstrong, I don't want to say it. The biker would pull over in some area where you can't see by helicopter. There's a guy waiting with a needle. Kate takes a quick injection. It's only for 15 minutes. It stays in the bloodstream, so it can't be detected later.
Wow.
And boom, he's off. So bad actors are always going to be ahead of the good actors.
Is virtue its own reward? I'm going to say yes. So we could.
And we've talked about this.
Yeah.
So here's a problem that I've had personally. So I had an idea a year and a half ago. So I've been involved in Bitcoin and crypto since about 2013. I built a store in 2013 to sell my book, Choose Yourself, before I released it. At first in 2013 or 2012, I was a skeptic. Naval Ravikant, who's been on the podcast in 2013, convinced me otherwise, and then I became a strong believer. In mid-2017, I had a philosophy and belief about Bitcoin, and I also believed that 95% of cryptos would be obsolete because they were scams. I said this on CNBC in mid-2017. But I started doing all these ads that were very intense, let's put it that way. And so people who never even read the product and never really verified whether I was good or bad thought I was bad because of these aggressive ads. And so yes, virtue is its own reward, but I had so many people literally giving me death threats because of these ads. And there's a video by Alain de Botton, the philosopher, who we have booked for this podcast, but he's never actually come on. There's a video he made, Nice Guys Need to Use Machiavellian Tactics. And his point is, if there is a scammer advertising a product and a nice guy advertising a product, the nice guy can't just say, hey, I'm the nice guy, buy my product. The scammer is using all the cognitive biases and tricks in the book.
Sure.
You've got to use their tricks, even if you're the nice guy.
Wow.
And so I don't know how you personally solve that problem. If you're the nice guy and you have a good product that you believe in, but you have to use these techniques to sell, and then everybody hated me. I had a good product, and because the ads were so aggressive, they were everywhere, and I would get all these magazines were saying, "Who is this
idiot?" But I think that look, in life, we all have trust and attention, right? We have people's trust and attention, and we all have to maintain it. Like when we do this podcast, we have to be not about ourselves. We have to be about, we have their trust. We appreciate all you listeners out there for listening, and we have your attention, and we want to maintain it. So in your case, despite the, come on of some of those approaches, you're giving good information. You're doing
95% of Bitcoin's or cryptocurrencies did become obsolete.
So,
like, I was correct, and I don't mean to advertise it now. Don't buy it. You can read my articles, but I had to get the word out because I saw so many listeners buying some of these scams. So, and it costs money to do this. It costs infrastructure. So you have to charge, and then you have to make ads, and you have to use, as Alain de Botton says, you have to use the Machiavellian tactics that the maybe not so good players are using.
Sure. And I think, look, it speaks to what you were talking about.
With the steroids.
Steroids with a lot of different areas. And look, we each have to make a covenant with ourselves to say, okay, what are we willing to do to get there? You know?
Yeah. We'll close with this. This podcast was ostensibly about problems without solutions that we've uncovered in this podcast over the past couple of years. I think we hit on four or five of them, maybe a little bit more. And then we talked in general about solutions that probably no one will follow up. And maybe we'll go back to the drawing board, look back at our guests and see what other problems have been brought up.
Yeah, but
all right.
Good times, James. Thank you. Podcast famous. Yeah.
How long was that one?